From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, Christopher Conover tells us about a new Arizona law that will make it possible for residents as young as 16 to donate blood. I'll talk with Karen Galino about her labor of love, the organization Deploy Peace. They use airplane scrap metal from Davis-Monthan to promote peace and benefit veterans in a unique way. A new book published by the UA Press documents the poverty that exists along the border and looks at what life is like for those living in the impoverished settlements known as colonias. Luis Carrion brings us the story. And Claudine LaMonaco introduces us to another storyteller from the Miners Story Project. Today it's Lynn Taylor, who talks about the challenges she faced as one of the first women to be hired in the male-dominated world of mining. That's all coming up on Arizona Spotlight. Arizona will soon be joining a number of other states in allowing 16-year-olds to donate blood. Local blood bank managers say that the new law will be taking effect just in time, as Christopher Conover reports.
Right now, the shelves at the American Red Cross Blood Services Arizona Regional Bank are not empty, but they're not full either. The Red Cross Blood Services are hoping to collect 66,000 pints of blood this year in Arizona. So the change in the law allowing 16-year-olds with parental consent to donate blood could be a major boon for blood banks, according to Deborah Denninger with the American Red Cross Blood Services Arizona region.
Only 38% of the U.S. population is currently eligible to give blood, and of that 38%, only a very small percent actually donate. That's why it's so important to bring 16-year-olds with parental consent into that donor pool.
Adding to blood stocks with 16-year-olds is nothing new in the United States. In fact, nearly half of the states already allow it. And younger donors in Arizona account for 20% of all donations, according to Denninger.
In the past year, our 17 and 18-year-old donors contributed nearly 5,000 pints to our blood collections in Arizona. We're hoping that when we bring 16-year-olds with their parental consent into the donor base, that we can grow that even more. We know there's a good potential there.
Across town at UMC is the only level one trauma center in the area. So Dr. Mary Berg, who oversees the hospital's blood bank, says University Medical Center keeps a three-day supply of blood on the shelves at all times.
We know that we transfuse an average of 12,000 red cell units a year. And so if you have that much, you can figure it out. It's about 1,000 units a month. So kind of averages out that way.
UMC blood bank managers know the value of getting more donors in the system.
A lot of times, the people who are deferred for donation, it's either because their blood counts are low, they have a low hemoglobin level, or they're underweight. But I think that there are a lot of 16-year-olds out there who have plenty of weight on their bones who are perfectly able of giving blood, and they're healthy. You know, 16-year-olds on average are going to be much healthier than older people, and I think that it's a good thing for them to learn at an early age. It's something that they can do as a positive contribution to the neighborhood.
Arizona residents on average give only 1.5 times a year when they could donate blood up to 6 times a year. Combine that with the fact that the demographics of Arizona are aging, and the Red Cross's Deborah Denninger says that is why the organization pushed for the change in Arizona law.
As our population ages, especially the baby boomers, we're going to have more and more people who are going to need blood. At the same time, these people may develop health problems that will take them out of the donor base. Again, another reason why it's so important to grow a new generation of blood donors in that 16 to 25-year-old age range. We're hoping that they can help keep that blood supply stable and safe by being lifetime donors.
As the new school year begins, the Red Cross is ready to recruit new donors.
We know there aren't a lot of things that 16-year-olds can do to impact the world and make a difference, but here's something really easy and relevant and important they can do to be a lifetime contributor to their community. Giving blood is simple, it doesn't take very long, and it's a civic duty.
The legislation allowing 16-year-olds to donate blood goes into effect at the end of September. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
When Karen Gulino's son was deployed for a tour of duty in Iraq, she was suddenly confronted with the worries and the sense of helplessness that all military moms must face. But in Karen's case, she and her friend Barbara Donaldson felt compelled to turn that energy in a new direction and find some way to make a positive contribution. The organization that they began is called Deploy Peace, and I asked Karen to come to the studio and tell us more about the unique way they found to help returning veterans and their families.
Deploy Peace is a company that we started a year ago. We wanted to do something to help the soldiers that were coming home. We didn't know what. We didn't know where to start. We just knew we wanted to do something. So we decided that first we should find an organization that we believed in, and that turned out to be the Fisher House. Then we decided that we needed to come up with a product because everybody wanted to do something to help, but nobody knew what. And that's where I came from with my son being deployed in Iraq. It was a helplessness. It was wanting to do something but not knowing what to do. And one day I was riding by the boneyard and the salvage yard, and I'm like, what a shame that there's all that plane just sitting there. And I got the idea of, what if we recycled that into something? And so we thought about it. My business partner, Barbara Donaldson, we decided that dog tags. That way there we could honor the soldiers, honor the ones that have served, honor them with a dog tag style, use the military aircraft to do that, and sell them and give a large portion of our proceeds to the Fisher House Foundation. How we came up with Deploy Peace was, deploy was a word that was being used everywhere at the time because so many troops were being deployed, you know, and we wanted to try to use that word in a positive way.
Tell us more about the Fisher House program and how that works.
Okay, the Fisher House Foundation, what they do is they build comfort homes right next to the medical facilities on base, near base.
So the family and loved ones of a vet who's receiving
right,
care.
Right, when they come home and they're going to be in the hospital for, you know, a certain amount of time, this allows the families to be close by.
So what you and Barbara eventually came up with is a dog tag design that has on the front a picture of a B-52 and a logo for Deploy Peace that sort of resembles a peace sign. And then on the other side, you have quotes from poets. I see one here from John Lennon. I know there's some from John F. Kennedy and Benjamin Franklin.
Correct.
How did you go about selecting these particular quotes?
The B-52, if you notice, the design has the bombs pulled off. We pulled the wings back to make the peace sign, minus the bombs, because it's the military aircraft that we're using. So we wanted the aircraft to be in part of the logo.
Mm-hmm.
The quotes, a lot of them we just looked up. And we went to family and friends and asked which ones that they liked the most, and we took the most popular. And we spent some time on Venice Beach last summer displaying the necklaces to get feedback to see how people responded to them, which we got a great response. Everybody loved them. A lot of military people stopped by and gave us a couple of quotes that they would have liked to see on them, so we now use them as well.
And is all of your material drawn from the Davis-Monthan and Boneyard?
It's from the salvage yard across the street. We get it from National Aircraft, and we go and we pick our pieces. We hand-pick all of them. We buy doors, side panels, wings, wing flaps, anything that can be used. Some of it we cannot use because it's too thick, and if we can't break it down, you know, to get at the thickness of the dog tag, then we can't use it. There's a gentleman there that helps us because we want military aircraft that was once used during a war. We have all of our pieces come from planes that flew either during the Korean War or the Vietnam War. And we just purchased a wing from a C-130 that flew during the early Vietnam War just a week ago.
How many dog tags do you think you can make out of a single wing?
It varies. And it depends on the material of the plane because we do not melt these down. We do not process them in any way. All we do is pull them apart. We drill all the rivets out ourselves, and then we bring them to be cut into the dog tag style. It's hard to say. Out of a wing, I'm going to guess maybe 4,000.
So you don't do anything to treat them or to prepare them?
All we do is we power hose them down to get all the dirt
Well, I noticed this one in particular has
rust,
rust and some scoring and just little marks on it. Yeah,
and a lot of them do. A lot of them, sometimes you can't even read the whole quote or you can't even see the whole logo because there's scrape marks on them. I mean, these planes flew. They're old.
And is all the work on the dog tags done here in Tucson?
No, they're actually cut into the dog tags up in Phoenix, but they are laser engraved here in Tucson. Mm-hmm. Like that one there, I know, came from the Bombardier door to the B-52 because it has the white on it, and the backs of the doors were white.
So you're actually learning an awful lot about military hardware yourself through this process, I guess.
Yes,
and
we are.
And metallurgy.
Barbara's husband does most of the hard work. It takes a long time. It takes about, like, one of the doors to the B-52, it takes him about 2 weeks to pull that apart and drill all the rivets out.
And this entire process from the time that you were first inspired to do it has been about a year?
A year, January, when we had the idea. We got it going by April.
It's moved very quickly.
We really wanted to make a difference. And we put a lot of thought into it. We really feel that this product, not only is someone getting something for helping, you're getting a piece of history. You're getting to help a wounded soldier coming home, reunite with their families. And what better gift is that? And, we're recycling,
That's true.
So
yeah. The front of the dog tag features a B-52 in a circle, placed so that it creates the image of a peace sign. Have you encountered any conflict from veterans or from their families over using this image in a product that's intended to benefit veterans?
No. Actually, the veterans are the ones that have the most positive response. We've encountered many, 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 many Vietnam veterans over the last year who just absolutely love the idea. Some peace groups question the logo, but once we explain it to and they know what we're doing, then they're okay with it.
How long have you been living in Tucson?
For 7 years.
And where did you come from?
Scottsdale.
Before that,
Boston. Yes, I'm from Boston.
Uh-huh. Okay. And what brought you out to Arizona originally?
Weather.
And that worked out for you pretty good, huh?
Yes, it did. I got rid of the snow shovel and the ice scraper, and that was it.
We have a link to the Deploy Peace website, as well as more information on all of the stories you hear on Arizona Spotlight. You'll find it all online at KUAZ.org. We'll have more Arizona Spotlight right after this break. The current economic downturn in our country is affecting almost every demographic, landing the poorest citizens in Arizona in a very difficult situation. Some of them have taken refuge by living in settlements called colonias. They're characterized by low-quality housing, no infrastructure, and high levels of poverty and unemployment. A new book documents the history of colonias, and next, Luis Carrion will talk to one of the authors and some of the individuals who were trying to break out of the cycle of poverty that dominates life in the colonias.
It might come as a surprise to many of us, but currently about 500,000 people live in officially designated colonias in southern Arizona and New Mexico, in some of the most economically deprived conditions in the U.S.
There's a lot of complex reasons for why we see the growth of the settlements, but there's economic reasons and there's policy reasons.
Now, a new book published by the U of A Press and authored by Adriana Esparza and Angela Donaldson seeks to shed some light on the situation in these impoverished border communities.
Our book is called Colonias in Arizona and New Mexico, Border Poverty and Community Development Solutions. We wanted to shed some light on what do we see happening in terms of Arizona and New Mexico. A lot of folks don't even know that we have these kind of settlements in Arizona, that we have poverty right outside our back door here in Tucson. And I think it was important for us to share what was happening and why these communities developed, how they've grown over time. And also, instead of just showing the problems, but what kind of solutions people have been able to develop and how government organizations like counties, federal government, nonprofits may be able to help residents in their quest to improve their communities.
85706 is the zip code that encompasses an area of Tucson that few people other than its residents are familiar with. Known as the Old Nogales Highway Colonia, it's an enclave of Pima County that is marked by poverty and limited infrastructure. The area is part of Pima County District 2, and for supervisor Ramon Valdez, the designation of Colonia reveals the unique problems faced by residents.
Several years ago, we designated the Old Nogales Colonia as a model colonia, and the designation is a very simple one. It, at the time, was the only model colonia in the state of Arizona to receive special designation not only from the state of Arizona, from Pima County, but from the federal government, in order to try and identify and try and resolve some of the real pressing needs that this community had.
The problems of this community, which now consists of around 1,600 households, are many, and the residents have to contend with unpaved streets, lack of public transportation, and unscrupulous landowners that subdivide their property without any regulations.
I mean, I think people want to have paved streets out here. They want to have better lighting. They want to have a bigger clinic if possible, maybe even a hospital if it could be possible, but that's in a long term. Maybe a grocery store. So there's a lot of things that this community wants and needs.
For the residents of the Old Nogales Highway Colonia, change has been elusive, but now they are organizing at the grassroots level. Adolfo Araiza heads the Neighborhood Resource Center and is part of a group that is seeking to affect change in the area by first organizing their efforts as a community.
There's been a lot of growth, especially within the last 5 years. This area out here has grown like maybe, I would say, 75% more than when I moved here.
For residents like Elsa Cocoa, who has lived at South Country Club Road for more than 20 years, the changes in the community have long been overdue.
The road conditions and the water conditions, because everybody out here lives on wells. Some people own private wells, and they come and they say that the person cut off their water for no reason, and the gas. It takes a long time for the police to get out here. The ambulance, by the time you call the ambulance, and they find you're at your home because there's no street addresses, there's nothing to let people know where to go, well, the person might die.
These colonias are some of the country's largest pockets of poverty. And for Angela Donaldson, who works as a consultant on housing and community development for nonprofits, understanding the dynamics of these communities is only the first step in finding the solutions.
People have incredible self-help capabilities. They have done so much for themselves. They've managed to survive and build a home and a life for themselves without assistance, for the most part. And so I think any efforts to capitalize upon those skills and abilities are really important and just help people extend those capabilities that they have.
The future of the Old Nogales Highway Colonia, like that of many communities, is dependent on the residents. The ability for them to affect change at the local level and at the political level will ultimately determine the future.
One of the things that I've asked to have happen is to begin empowering members of the community to start working together and to start identifying some of those things, both short and long term, that they and we can work together to resolve. So it's a very difficult process. It's a lengthy process. It's not going to be resolved today. Again, this is a problem that has existed for a very long time. It was created by the fact that this was a wildcat subdevelopment.
You know, working with Pima County and the way they're thinking is, let the people themselves get together first and let people start changing themselves and how they think and how they do things. And so it's a slow process. We know it. We're gonna be doing some things. We're going to be changing this community. I really believe that. It's just going to take some time.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
The University of Arizona's Mineral Museum is home to the Miners' Story Project. It consists of interviews conducted with miners and their families about what life was like in the mining towns of the Southwest. Next, Claudine LaMonaco introduces us to Lynn Taylor, our next storyteller from the Miners' Story Project.
58-year-old Lynn Taylor worked in Southern Arizona mines for 10 years, beginning in the mid-70s. But Taylor was an unlikely miner. She grew up as a Catholic schoolgirl in Tucson. After a couple years in college, she moved to San Francisco and became a yoga-practicing, commune-living hippie. A couple years later, she came back to Tucson and spent nearly a year looking for a good-paying job. She never dreamed she'd end up in the mines. Taylor describes to Miner Project producer Shepard Reed how she got the job and what life was like as one of the first women miners.
Probably the first time I realized that there were copper mines was when I read an article in the paper saying about a woman who was just hired as the first woman miner, and she drove heavy equipment. And they were publicizing that they needed people, they needed minorities because they had federal contracts and they needed to meet that. And so I thought, well, you know, this might be a good opportunity to make some good money. And I think at that time it was like $6 an hour, but that was really good. So I thought, well, it would be worth just to see, and maybe I could work like for a month and make my rent. And then it ended up that, you know, I worked for on and off for 10 years with the mine. This friend of mine was a male. He and I decided to go out. And when I got out there, I believe there were hundreds. You know, I thought there were about 500 people standing in line. We were there all day long. And I was pretty awestruck by everything, including knowing that I had never even handled a wrench or done anything. I mean, I just thought, why am I out here? I know nothing about any of this stuff. So I waited in line along with everybody else, and I walked in, and there were several guys, you know, sitting at a desk, and they took one look at me and said, okay, you're hired. And I thought, well, geez, why did I have to stand in line for so long? Because I was a woman. The job I was given was lube man. Basically, I drove a lube truck, which is what you see on construction sites, and you would drive this lube truck down into the pit and oil, fuel up the... You were like the gas station attendant, I guess, basically. And also, then you also were required to work at the shop, which was changing oil and lubricating and doing all that kind of thing in the large heavy equipment. And truthfully, I mean, the pit, doing the lube truck was the job that I could do. Working in the shop was difficult. It was something that I really couldn't do. I mean, these oil filters on these trucks, you know, are like huge. And I remember, I mean, I have this really good recollection of this Hispanic guy who was not at all excited that I was working there. And I mean, I was no help to him either, probably. And we were sitting under this truck, and he was just watching me try to get this filter off, you know, as the hot oil is coming over everywhere. And I mean, this guy had like these muscles out to here, you know, and he's just looking at me like, you've made a big mistake here. I mean, I really did experience over all the time that I worked there a lot of negative feelings towards me. At the beginning, I really was kind of alone. You know, I mean, I really didn't get you know, it seemed like people kind of stayed away from me a little bit. And I think I stayed away from them. You know, my job was a lube man. Every day I would get dumped with diesel and be dirty as heck. But for almost 6 months, we, the women, had no changing facilities. We had no bathrooms. I mean, the bathroom in the shop was, you know, this round circular thing that everybody go in and wash their hands, and two or three toilet areas with no doors on them. So for the longest time, I didn't even go to the bathroom when I was there. And then they put doors on. And then finally, I just couldn't handle it anymore. I had to go in. And as soon as you would walk in, you know, if the guys were washing up or something, there'd be like total silence. And you kind of look which way the feet were pointing, and you know that you could go in. And then about 6 months, but we had no shower facilities. I remember carpooling with these people, and I would smell of diesel all the way home. These guys would go in, change their clothes, and we would have to. I would remember going into my apartment, going outside to my backyard, and just tearing off all the clothes that I had. And thank God I lived in the back of Value Village, so I could go and look for my, off of 4th Avenue, so I could go look for my attire. The diesel would just kind of eat up your clothes. And then they divided an area off and gave it to the women for, you know, of the men. But it went like from, you know, it went to the ridiculous point where it would be me and one other woman and with rows of lockers and nobody else in the place. And we would, the showers, you know, those shower areas and all the shower heads there, we would just turn them all on and just go racing back and forth because, you know, I mean, we had nobody there. So that was kind of from the sublime to the ridiculous, I guess.
In collaboration with the U of A's Mineral Museum, the Miners' Story Project will preserve this piece of Arizona history as part of a digital archive. The project's coordinator, Shepard Reed, has conducted over 200 interviews so far, and will continue to bring you some of them here on Arizona Spotlight. And now here's Rose Brandt, presenting the Arizona Spotlight Community Calendar.
The Other Voices Women's Reading Series continues tonight. Antigone Books on 4th Avenue has refreshments and open mic night for all women poets. The event starts at 7 p.m. and is open to the public. Burn some calories and get a great cardio workout while dancing to Latin world rhythms. No dance experience required this Saturday at the Zumba Fitness Dance Class in the historic Y Hall on the corner of 5th Avenue and University at 10 a.m. Dirty Dogs Wanted. Volunteers at the Arizona Greyhound Rescue Dog Wash will get your canine friend clean as a whistle from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Veterinary Specialty Center. More information is at azgreyhoundrescue.org. We use them every day, hopefully. But have you ever wondered about toothbrush history? Brushella the Tooth Fairy is your guide through toothbrush history this Sunday at Branches, Bristles, and Batteries at the Tucson Children's Museum, beginning at 10 a.m. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Rose Brandt.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood and Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Podcasts of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.